We're going to talk about Father's Day for dads who have lost a child. Unimaginable to some in our listening audience. But what comes after that? How do you put your life together? We're going to find out how Paul Sinsar did it on the Ed Till Show on Starcom Radio Network. Stand by. Paul Sinsar is our guest on the Ed Till Show. Hey, Paul, how are you today?
Hey, Ed, how are you? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, we're in New York, but the country is just abuzz today. Again, one of these dramatic shootings. Father's Day is not the same after you lose a child. How did this happen to you? How did your life get turned upside down?
Well, my wife and I, we sort of were having a great time living in New York City. We were there for almost 20 years. In our late 20s, we were enjoying our careers and we were enjoying each other. And finally, we both hit our early 30s and said, you know, I think it's time to get married. You realize that when it comes to starting a family, that the biological clock is ticking a little bit, and it's starting to slow down. It slows down dramatically after 35. So we got to work, and there was a lot of fun in the trying, but a lot of frustration as well. We ended up getting pregnant, and my wife had a miscarriage when we were on a trip over to Switzerland. But we put our heads down, and we eventually were having a lot of problems that, as many people do, who put off having a family into their 30s, put it off for careers or whatever. And we decided to go, you know, seek some help. We moved to Denver in 1990 and found a fellow who was a brilliant scientist. I won't mention his name. He's gotten a lot of people pregnant. And we got pregnant. And we were going to have a daughter, and I was absolutely delighted because women are my favorite gender. Everything was going along very well, and 10 days before her due date, we went in for an OB appointment, and our daughter, Catherine, had been quiet the night before. She didn't respond much to her OJ in the morning. And, you know, it's one of those times when you're with a doctor and they're saying one thing and you're watching their face. And when I saw him put the stethoscope on her belly and looked at his face, I knew that we had a serious problem. Long story short, she had a crash C-section. I was there with her during it. Our daughter was born, and she had gone without oxygen too long. And there are all kinds of stories of people that have lost children in all different ways, and they're all horrendous. She'd gone without oxygen too long, and they suspect it was too short an umbilical cord that cut off the flow of blood. And unfortunately, it was devastating. To get technical, it was called HIE, hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, which means she just didn't get enough blood and oxygen to her brain, and it got fried. She was cortically deaf, cortically blind. We think she could follow black and white. She had high tone, low tone CP, cerebral palsy, couldn't suck or swallow, had to be fed in a G-tube, and so we had her for 7 months, so it was an awful 7 months for her. For us, we took some consolation in the fact that we got to be parents for 7 months. In September of 1992, the night nurse came in, and Katie was gone. Just, you know, over time, there were too many spaces in her brain that had filled up with cerebral spinal fluid and put pressure on all the autonomic functions, and that was it. She just couldn't take anymore. But she was a great kid and a tough kid, and we both had different experiences being parents with her.
So what happens after the initial shock And then, you know, everybody pays their respects and there's grieving and there's mourning. What's on the other side of life after that dramatic loss?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is the two of us, Linda and I, had a tremendously strong relationship. We're kind of soulmates, I guess. We're a little different, but and you begin the process of trying to deal with it as soon as it happens. I think, and as you probably know, I've written a couple of books, novels, that have helped me. But you start dealing with it right away. But each person, and I think this is important to understand, each person in the relationship, the mom and the dad, may deal with it very differently. You know, if you think about people see, you know, a sine curve that goes up and down, the little waves. Well, sometimes, you know, you're in a valley and your wife's okay and she's in a peak. And sometimes you're both at a peak or a valley. And you have to understand that grieving is a process that is very individual, and each person has to go through it in their own way, and each person grieves for every loss in a different way. So my wife and I had, Linda kind of got a head start on me. The morning after Katie was born, the nurses came running in. I was taking a shower. I'd been up all night, and I lost it. I mean, I had a complete meltdown. But after that, I kind of just put off the grieving, I guess, in the morning, and I just looked at myself as her dad and tried to fulfill that role. Linda, on the other hand, as I talk about my heroine Kate in my first book, Sun Valley Moon Mountains, she would be up every night on a little stool in the bathroom, just crying her eyes out, just everything that she felt inside. But then, you know, once the sun was up, you're two parents that have a damaged kid. There's no time to think about yourself. You have to take care of that child. So she actually, by the time Katie had died, she had gone through quite a bit of the mourning process. I hadn't. And then it started for me. And I guess, you know, Father's Day, I've written an essay, I think, that's going to be in the Huffington Post this Sunday under my pen name, Ajax Minor. Mm-hmm. And it was the second Father's Day that I spent, the one without her, and that's when it just hit me like a bus. It was a trigger. It wasn't anything special about the third Sunday in June, but right. It was a real trigger, and I just let it out, and then I began the process of deep mourning, and we helped each other through it, and frankly, my, you know, taking and putting my thoughts down on paper was something that was extremely helpful.
So that's how this fantasy series began. Did you deliberately go there and start the writing project in order to drain some of this out of you? Was it coincidental? What do you think the combination of the two coming together like that were? Was this refuge for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was spontaneous at first. As I kind of describe in the foreword in the first book, the way it happened, we about 6 months after Katie had died, and we were just taking an afternoon nap. We were living in Colorado. It was an icy cold day, and it was brilliant sun, and we faced west. It was warm in the bedroom. Linda was breathing heavily within 2 minutes. She's a great sleeper. I just was lying there, and I got this little idea for I was thinking about Katie. I got this little idea for a short story that eventually became a much longer novel that has become now three novels, of which the first two have been published. And as I began to work through it, I there were two things that I thought about. One was, what is this doing for me? And I think, you know, grief can express itself in many ways. It can be resignation. It can be horror. It can be just a complete helplessness. For me, there was some joy actually in writing it, because I got to create mm-hmm. another life for right. for my daughter Catherine, whom right. is called Ur, which is an ancient city in Iraq, I got to create another life for her in this book and in subsequent books, and So for me, that's been just enormously valuable, not having her physical presence. The other reason for doing it is, you know, hoping that other people who have gone through something like this can look for a way to deal with their grief. And as I said, there are many different ways of grieving. And, you know, some of them, people find solace in religion. Other people, you know, take a different path. But I think that, you know, people have to look for a way in which to explain what happened.
Right.
You know, the why is always the question that you ask. Why? And so what I wanted to show people was a different way, the way that my wife Linda and I grieved, and this is with my two characters, Jack and Kate, in the first book, and that they took sort of a more objective approach to it. It was more stoic, and we finally just came to the conclusion that I guess Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching said, you know, nature does not play favorites; she regards her creations without sentimentality, and we just came, you know, the world is the way it is, and things happen, and nature's not cruel, but nature, just things happen, and we sort of accepted that, and that was one of the things that helped us. And in my books, I have my two main protagonists, my hero and my heroine, who have that view. So, you know, there's a different way of doing it. There's a very religious way of doing it. There are people that may lose a child. We got a lot of cards, you know, when after Katie had died, and some of them had, you know, bluebirds and flowers, and, you know, some people need a soft touch. They just have to have that. Some people have to find solace in religion, and
right.
We just found it in trying to figure out what had happened, and we came to a conclusion that may or may not be correct, but it helped us. And I wanted to show that to other people, and, you know, tell people that there are different ways of grieving.
Sure. The joy of the creation, you think, is a direct result of how awful the weight was on you, and that it's kind of like a chemical reaction kind of thing. You open up a place for the energy to go.
Yeah, you know, I think I hadn't really thought about that, but I think that's true. You know, when you're writing, you don't have a paintbrush, and, you know, so you can't express grief like Picasso did with Guernica, the bombing of Guernica. Most people will remember that. I think if they don't remember the name, they'll remember that, you know, the horse that was screaming.
Right.
Or in sculpture, in the Pietà. Mm-hmm. And you're from the Bronx, right? Originally?
I am. Sure. Yep.
So, and you were, I think you're sort of a contemporary. You're kind of a kid. You were born in 1956. I Googled you. I hope that you don't mind.
That's
that,
it. Yeah, you got it. 61 right here, man, from Mars
okay.
Park Avenue in the Bronx.
All right. Well,
yeah.
Well, we lived in Brooklyn for 15 years, so forget about it. But you probably then, because you would have been, what was you have been? You would have been 8, and I was about 14. You
oh,
probably went
Kennedy
to the World's Fair, right?
Oh, World's Fair, right. That's right. Yeah, I got my camera. I got my Kodak camera, the official camera of the World's Fair. Absolutely.
Fantastic. That was great. And one of the things at the World's Fair that was one of the biggest deals, if you'll remember, was the Pietà by Michelangelo.
Oh, yeah.
Actually brought that thing over from Italy.
Right.
And I was just, you know, I was only 14, but I was stunned by it. And here's this pouring of pure, unconditional love, agape, I guess the Greeks called it, in from Mary into her son.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a real religious person, but I didn't grow up that way. But boy, that really struck me. And so, one of the things that happens, yeah, I think it's a chemical reaction. We're kind of a bag of chemicals, aren't we, Ed?
Exactly.
I mean, really, when you
That's
think
it.
About it.
Yep.
And so, different emotions are sparked, and for me, being able to create this little girl. Who in the first book her parents go on a quest to rescue, and seeing how she turned out was really fun. There are times when I still can reread certain passages, like when she confronts the main antagonist in a showdown, and I just kind of gives me chills. And then my second book. My daughter, call her my daughter, she's about 20. And it's a little different book. It's more of a fantasy dystopian kind of a thing. It takes place in the future.
Right.
And I just see how she's turned out. And I just, you know, for me, I don't know if she would have turned out that way. We often talk about it. What
right.
would she have been? Who cares if she'd been alive as long as she was happy?
Right.
And so, anyway, I, you know, that gives me their time, their passages I read there. And it still gives me a kick every time I read it.
Now, have you guys ever thought about trying again or adopting, or is this the experience and that's it? You move on to another phase of life?
You know, I think everybody has to make that decision. We had been trying for, well, we married in 1982, so she was died in 1990, so 10 years, you know, and this
wow.
was the yeah. result. Linda at that time was 40.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are other things you have to consider,
right.
especially when you're, whether you're trying to get pregnant naturally or whether you're undergoing fertility treatment.
Sure.
You know, once you hit 40, then the consequences of pregnancy, the potential for, you know, for genetic problems.
Oh, yeah, right.
I mean, it increases exponentially, really.
Sure.
But we did, after she died, we tried again with this doc, and... I don't know. I don't think things happen for a reason. I don't think things are meant to be. But when he was going to implant her, he had the embryos in a syringe, and
mm-hmm.
he lost them. So where'd they go? I don't know, on the floor. I don't know what happened.
Wow.
Well, I lost them.
Wow.
Which for a whole bunch of reasons is pretty horrifying. After that, Linda wanted to try again. And I said, you know, you've been on these drugs and these hormones and... I don't want you to get cancer. I don't want you to die on me.
Right.
She did get cancer. She didn't die.
Mm.
So that's the decision we made. And then I think a lot of people also, you know, you mentioned adoption, and that was something we wrestled with. We wrestled with surrogate pregnancy. We wrestled with adoption. We elected not to adopt, and I think most of it was probably anecdotal. It seemed like in half of the cases, people have had wonderful experiences when they've adopted children,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen other couples whose lives and the lives of the adopted children have just been a complete mess and ruined. And you know, a kid's not a car; you can't bring it back and sell it back to the dealer when you're done. So
sure.
it's a lifetime commitment. And we just said, you know, we've sort of been through enough. Enough is enough.
Paul, it's an extraordinary story. Does the series continue now? You'll continue to write in this series, or do you feel the series is complete? You've got three books. I want to mention the titles. You said one earlier, Sun Valley, Moon Mountains, The Girl from Ipanema, which was just released in March, and Kutuzov's Dream. Did I murder that? How do I pronounce
it? No,
that?
You did it. No, that's great. That's perfect. You could... you could be our Russian ambassador.
Wow. That's not as hard as I thought it was watching Washington these days, right? So let me ask you, where does the series go now? Does this series now become a life's work for you, or do you see that this series comes to an end and you continue writing? What's on the drawing board for you?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. No, I'm going to continue to write, and I do write. I write a little bit of poetry, and I write some short stories, which most of which can be found on my website under my pen name, Ajax Minor, ajaxminor.com, and we'll be posting more stories as we go along. So I'm going to keep writing. It's sort of when an idea hits you. I wouldn't say I'm prolific. It's a big project, you know. It's three books. You're talking, you know, several years to write each book and edit it. So
wow.
it's over a decade long process. I have some ideas for sequels. We'll see how the series does. If there's enough interest in it and I feel motivated, I'll do it. I also have some ideas for a couple of other books. I sort of only write in fantasy.
Right.
And these are not, this isn't like Lord of the Rings, what they call high fantasy, or Game of Thrones. You know, no dragons, no elves or any
right,
of that stuff,
right.
but it still is fantasy. And that's what comes out of my pen, and when I get an idea, I'm going to write it down. But I do have some ideas for future books if these are happen to be popular enough. But it's a tough business to break into.
Yeah, you got that right. Right. Listen, art and writing have become big in your life. Were they always a go-to when there was tough times, when you were a kid, when you were an adolescent? Or is this a new side of you, and now it continues to grow?
No, that's a good question, and I think that's something that, you know, the listeners would probably be interested in, people who are motivated and want to write. Music was always important. I'm really not an artist. I took an art class in college, and so did my wife, and we know art generally, and we sort of know our way around a museum, but art isn't something that we're, the visual arts are something that we really are really tuned into. But music was always important to me, and to my wife. I performed in high school and college, and recently, you know, kind of given up the classical stuff, and I'm in a little rock band. So music was always important, and music was a great release. It was also a great release during, you know, during a lot of tough times. Music for sure. Writing is very interesting, because I took a back way back when in the 1960s when I took my SATs, they had something called a writing sample. So there was a grade of 1 to 5, and you had to write something, I forget what the heck it was, but fictional. So I took a writing sample, and I got a 5 on it. And I got this grade back. I said, that's the highest grade. That's ridiculous.
Right.
I can't write. I'm not a pro. I said, I can write academic prose, but I can't write fiction. And so that was it. And really, I guess what happened was, you know, to really write, you have to have a reason to do it. I wish I'd never had this reason to write, but I did. And once there was a reason to do it, this was an expression for me to put it down on paper, and I think it will continue to be a release. And I'll tell people, I hear people all the time say, I'd love to write, I just don't have the time. Well, what you really need is a reason, and if you have the reason, you have the time.
Yeah,
you'll
make the
time. It's a lot of nonsense.
Right.
It's a lot of nonsense. You don't have the time.
Exactly.
You can sit down
right.
Once a week, go get yourself one of those little black and white composition books at the supermarket. Get yourself a pen and sit down and once a week write 100 words. I mean, 100 words isn't very much. Well, you know, at the end of the year, you've got 5,000 words. That's a nice little short story.
Right.
So either get to the end of the year and not have your short story, or get to the end of the year and have your short story.
You know, I'm so glad you gave that example, because that's probably part of the therapy, is that original pen and ink expression. I was going to ask you earlier, so you kind of got to the subject first, I'm glad, whether you started writing on the phone or tapping on a screen, and there's just no comparison to cursive writing with a pen in your hand. It is so much more personal. It's so much more expressive. It just gets more out.
Do you write? I mean, you sound pretty passionate about it.
I've written since the 80s, and I've written columns, I've written short stories, much, much writing in my background. As a matter of fact, that was always my favorite thing in school. I loved creative writing. I was never without a story to tell. So I'll give you my memory.
Please.
Jimmy Carter was writing his book, and he was on either Carson or one of these talk shows talking about doing it on the computer. And I remember then feeling, wow, that is so weird. Tapping on plastic, watching these little green characters pop up. Even back then, it didn't sound like writing. And now it's taken over communication. So, you know, I have a very intimate relationship with exactly what you described. I love those 69-cent composition books and a brand new pen. And leave me alone. I'll be fine with just that.
No, that's very cool. And you know, the word processor. I mean, typing must have been absolutely brutal. But even on an electric typewriter.
Right,
but word processing. I sort of taught myself typing, and I learned 10 finger typing, but only 7 or 8 work at one time. So for me to be able to create a long work of fiction like this. Sometimes a short story, I'll use Word, but you know, for me to create a long work of fiction like this is impossible. So what I do is I use a fountain pen, that's a tip. If you don't use one, fountain pen's the greatest thing in the world, because it just flows across the page, and you don't end up getting cramps in your hand and all that. So a tip for people that want to write with a composition book, get an old-fashioned fountain pen. It's just such a great feeling, as you describe, to see these things flow onto the page. Then after that, I have what's called a manuscript typist.
Mm.
And she'll turn it into a Word document, and then she hands it back to me, and then it's time to edit, and I type well enough to be able to edit. And I will say that I like the creative process and editing equally well.
You do?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, some writers hate the creative process, love to edit, some vice versa, but I think they're both terrific. And if I could just put in, this is kind of connected to talk radio, let me put in a little plug for my manuscript typist. Her name is Joyce Krieg. She's out here in Central California, where I'm talking to you from, mm-hmm. Monterey area.
Right.
And she worked in talk radio back in the late 80s, early 90s, out of a station in Sacramento whose call letters I do not remember. Well, she's a pretty good author in her own right, and she wrote three books called The Talk Radio Mysteries, Murder on Mic, and a couple other murder mysteries, and there's this just a crackerjack heroine named Shauna J. Bogart, who's
right.
a wisecracking, super smart lady who has an afternoon talk show, and she has all these adventures, and she ends up trying to solve these crimes, and it's absolutely terrific. If you're in that business, Joyce Krieg, pick up her books, and she says it fondly. It's about a time back in the late 80s, early 90s, sort of the end of the independent talk radio stations before they started to get gobbled up, and she said it was just a different world.
Wow!
Awful lot of fun.
Oh, I will definitely jump all over this. Yeah,
you take that Word document and you go with it.
I'm going to grab that. How are the talk radio mysteries? That's awesome.
I think it's talk radio mysteries. It's Joyce Krieg, K-R-I-E-G, and she's on. Find her on Amazon.
We'll find her. We'll Google her up and get a hold of her, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, dude, I tell you, where did the half an hour go? You are a remarkable guest.
Have we been on for half an hour?
It's unbelievable.
Smoke.
And I want to say, for all the dads who are listening and, feel this kind of long-ago grief, they really need to hear this interview with us today. We're going to be replaying it. They need to get these books and see what the effect on you was, what can come from this. But your composure and the way you tell it is so accessible. I'm just so grateful to you for all the people that you've touched today. Paul, you've done a great job. And no one will know the pain that you and your wife felt. That is really singular to every human being. But what you've done with it is so universal. Thank you so much for today. I hope you'll come back and talk to us from time to time. Dads need to hear from dads like you, who have taken some of the worst moments that one could imagine and have turned them into life and beauty and a future. I love the idea that you're able now to experience your lost child as a young woman through your prose. That's a real gift, and I thank you for sharing it with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Ed, and I'd love to keep talking with you, but I'm sure you got to go to a commercial break. But thank you very much, and yeah, hopefully we will talk in the future. It's been terrific.
Oh, absolutely.
Nice to meet you.
What is the website you would like people to go to follow up with us today?
AjaxMinor.com. It's one word. Ajax is in either the cleanser or the Greek hero. Minor, M-I-N-O-R.
Right on.
AjaxMinor.com. That's my website. Check it out. There's some blogs. I've got this really smart young girl who's my social media guru.
Right.
Since I'm an old boomer who,
right.
stumbling around with it. I need somebody to hold my hand.
Rock and roll, man.
It's interesting. I'll leave you with one interesting anecdote, one thought, and that is, and it's in my little essay this weekend in the Huffington Post. There is a word in English for people who've lost spouses, widows and widowers. There's a word for kids who've lost parents. It's orphans. There is no word for parents who've lost kids.
Wow.
So
staggering. Yeah, that's staggering. From all the coverage that we do, that there's never been a moment to encapsulate that. Wow. That is a great provocative thought to leave us with. Paul Sinsar, congratulations on what you've done. Go to Ajax Minor, just the way it sounds, AJAXMINOR.com. And again, we're going to keep our eyes out for the talk radio mysteries that your wife wrote. Wow, you guys are something.
No, not my. It was my manuscript typist, not my wife.
Oh, okay, good. All right, I clarified that by making a big mistake. All right, listen, I thank you very much, Paul. Great visit today. We'll talk with you again soon.
As we say back in the boroughs, forget about it.
Forget about it. You got it. Wow. Paul Sinsar, he writes under the name Ajax Minor. He and his wife tried for so long to have a child, and when they did, they lost their daughter shortly thereafter. Many people would be done. It was a beginning for Paul, and now a three-book fantasy series called Legend, the Legend series, is available on Amazon. You can go to ajaxminor.com, get a hold of the series, read this, and see Life After Tragedy. Paul Sinsar on the Ed Till Show, Starcom Radio Network. A little bit late for the news, but we'll get you caught up on news, weather, traffic, and sports. Also, an early look at the upcoming close on Wall Street.